hundreds of shifting flecks of blue light, and stared in the same direction as he.
"Are you angry with me?"
she asked. "No, of course not. I understand that you could not break your oath in the ancient language. I just wish that Brom could have told me this himself, and that he hadn't felt it necessary to hide the truth from me." She swung her head toward him.
"And how do you feel, Aragorn?"
"You know as well as I."
"A few minutes ago I did, but not now. You have grown still, and looking into your mind is like peering into a lake so deep I cannot see the bottom. What is in you, little one? Is it rage? Is it happiness? Or have you no emotions to give?"
"What is in me is acceptance," he said, and turned to face her. "I cannot change who my parents are. I reconciled myself with that after the Burning Plains. What is, and no amount of gnashing teeth on my part will change that. I am glad, I think, to consider Brom my father, but I'm not sure. It's too much to grasp all at once."
"Perhaps what I have to give you will help. Would you like to see the memory Brom left for you? Or would you prefer to wait?"
"No, no waiting," he said. "If we delay, you may never have the opportunity."
"Then close your eyes, and let me show you what once was."
Aragorn did as she directed, and from Sephira there flowed a stream of sensations. Sights, sounds, smells, and more, everything that she had been experiencing at the time of the memory. Before him, Aragorn beheld a glade in the forest, somewhere among the foothills piled against the western side of the spine. The grass was thick and lush, and veils of chartreuse lichen hung from the tall, drooping, moss-covered trees. Due to the rains that swept inland from the ocean, the woods were far greener and wetter than those of Palancar Valley. As seen through Sephira's eyes, the greens and reds were more subdued than they would have been to Aragorn, while every hue of blue shone with additional intensity. The smell of moist soil and punky wood suffused the air, and in the center of the glade lay a fallen tree, and upon the fallen tree sat Brom. The hood of the old man's robe was pulled back to expose his bare head. Across his lap lay his sword. His twisted, rune-carved staff stood propped against the log. The ring Arran glittered on his right hand. For a long while, Brom did not move. And then he squinted up at the sky, his hooked nose casting a long shadow across his face. His voice rasped, and Aragorn swayed, feeling disjointed in time. Brom said, "Ever the sun traces its path from horizon to horizon, and ever the moon follows, and ever the days roll past without care for the lives they grind away, one by one." Lowering his eyes, Brom gazed straight at Sephira, and through her, Aragorn. "Try though they might, no being escapes death forever, not even the elves or the spirits. To all there is an end. If you are watching me, Aragorn, then my end has come, and I am dead. And you know that I am your father." From the leather pouch by his side, Brom drew forth his pipe, filled it with cardus weed, then lit it with a soft muttering of "Drisinger." He puffed on the pipe several times to set the fire, before he resumed talking. "If you do see this, Aragorn, I hope that you are safe and happy, and that Galbatorix is dead. However, I realize that's unlikely, if for no other reason than you are a dragon rider. And a dragon rider may never rest while there is injustice in the land." A chuckle escaped Brom, and he shook his head, his beard rippling like water. "Ah, I have not the time to say even half of what I would like.
I would be twice my current age before I finished. In the pursuit of brevity, I shall assume that Sephira has already told you how your mother and I met, how Selina died, and how I came to be in Carvajal. I wish that you and I could have this talk face to face, Aragorn, and perhaps we still shall, and Sephira will have no need to share this memory with you. But I doubt it. The sorrows of my years press on me, Aragorn, and I feel a cold creeping into my limbs the likes of which has never troubled me before. I think it is because I know it is now your turn to take up the standard. There is much I still hope to accomplish, but none of it is for myself, only for you. And you shall eclipse everything I have done. Of that I am sure. Before my grave closes over me, though, I wanted to be able, at least this once, to call you my son. My son. Your whole life, Aragorn, I have longed to reveal to you who I was. It has been a pleasure like no other for me to watch you growing up, but also a torture like no other, because of the secret I held in my heart. Brom laughed then, a harsh, barking sound. Ha! Well, I didn't exactly manage to keep you safe from the Empire, now did I? If you are still wondering who was responsible for Garrow's death, you need look no further, for here he sits. It was my own foolishness. I should never have returned to Carvajal. And now look, Garrow dead, and you a dragon rider. I warn you, Aragorn, beware of whom you fall in love with, for fate seems to have a morbid interest in our family. Wrapping his lips around the stem of his pipe, Brom drew on the smouldering cardus weed several times, blowing the chalk-white smoke off to one side. The pungent smell was heavy in Sephira's nostrils. Brom said, "I have my share of regrets, but you are not one of them, Aragorn. You may occasionally behave like a moon-addled fool, such as letting these blasted Urgles escape, but you are no more of an idiot than I was at your age." He nodded. "Less of an idiot, in fact. I am proud to have you as my son, Aragorn. Prouder than you will ever know. I never thought that you would become a rider as I was, nor wished that future upon you. But seeing you with Sephira, it makes me feel like crowing at the sun like a rooster." Brom drew on the pipe again. "I realize you may be angry at me for keeping this from you. I can't say I would have been happy to discover the name of my own father this way. Whether you like it or not, though, we are family, you and I. Since I could not give you the care I owed you as your father, I will give you the one thing I can instead, and that is advice. Hate me if you wish, Aragorn. But heed what I have to say, for I know whereof I speak." With his free hand, Brom grasped the sheath of his sword, the veins prominent on the back of his hand. He fixed the pipe in one corner of his mouth. "Right. Now my advice is twofold. Whatever you do, protect those you care for. Without them, life is more miserable than you can imagine. An obvious statement, I know, but no less true because of it. There, that is the first part of my advice. As for the rest, if you are so fortunate as to have already killed Galbatorix, or if anyone has succeeded in slitting that traitor's throat, then congratulations. If not, then you must realize that Galbatorix is your greatest and most dangerous enemy. Until he is dead, neither you nor Sephira will ever find peace. You may run to the farthest corners of the earth, but unless you join the Empire, one day you will have to confront Galbatorix. I am sorry, Aragorn, but that is the truth of it. I have fought many magicians and several of the Forsworn,
and so far I have always defeated my opponents." The lines on Brom's forehead deepened.
"Well, all but once, but that was because I was not yet fully grown. Anyway, the reason I have always emerged triumphant is that I use my brain, unlike most. I am not a strong spellcaster, nor are you, compared with Galbatorix. But when it comes to a wizard's duel, intelligence is even more important than strength. The way to defeat another magician is not by battering blindly against his mind. No. In order to ensure victory, you have to figure out how your enemy interprets information and reacts to the world. Then you will know his weaknesses, and there you strike. The trick isn't inventing a spell no one else has ever thought of before. The trick is finding a spell your enemy has overlooked and using it against him. The trick isn't ploughing your way through the barriers in someone's mind. The trick is slipping underneath or around the barriers. No one is omniscient, Aragorn. Remember that. Galbatorix may have immense power, but he cannot anticipate every possibility. Whatever you do, you must remain nimble in your thinking. Do not become so attached to any one belief that you cannot see past it to another possibility. Galbatorix is mad and therefore unpredictable, but he also has gaps in his reasoning that an ordinary person would not. If you can find those, Aragorn, then perhaps you and Saphira can defeat him.
Brom lowered his pipe, his face grave.
I hope you do. My greatest desire, Aragorn, is that you and Saphira will live long and fruitful lives, free from fear of Galbatorix and the Empire. I wish that I could protect you from all of the dangers that threaten you. But alas, that is not within my ability. All I can do is give you my advice and teach you what I can now, while I am still here, my son. Whatever happens to you, know that I love you, and so did your mother. May the stars watch over you, Aragorn Bromson.
As Brom's final words echoed in Aragorn's mind, the memory faded away, leaving behind empty darkness. Aragorn opened his eyes and was embarrassed to find tears running down his cheeks. He uttered a choked laugh and wiped his eyes on the edge of his tunic.
"Brom really was afraid that I would hate him," he said, and sniffed.
"Are you going to be all right?"
Saphira asked.
"Yes," said Aragorn, and lifted his head. "I think I will, actually. I don't like some of the things Brom did, but I am proud to call him my father, and to carry his name. He was a great man. It bothers me, though, that I never had the opportunity to talk to either of my parents as my parents."
"At least you were able to spend time with Brom. I am not so fortunate. Both my sire and my mother died long before I hatched. The closest I can come to meeting them are a few hazy memories from Gleda."
Aragorn put a hand on her neck, and they comforted each other as best they could, while they stood upon the edge of the crags of Telnea and gazed out over the forest of the elves. Not long afterward, Oromis emerged from his hut, carrying two bowls of soup, and Aragorn and Saphira turned away from the crags and slowly walked back to the small table in front of Gleda's immense bulk.
Souls of Stone. As Aragorn pushed away his empty bowl, Oromis said, "Would you like to see a fairth of your mother, Aragorn?"
Aragorn froze for a moment, astonished.
"Yes, please."
From within the folds of his white tunic, Oromis withdrew a shingle of thin grey slate, which he passed to Aragorn. The stone was cool and smooth between Aragorn's fingers. On the other side of it, he knew he would find a perfect likeness of his mother, painted by means of a spell with pigments an elf had set within the slate many years ago. A flutter of uneasiness ran through Aragorn. He had always wanted to see his mother, but now that the opportunity was before him, he was afraid that the reality might disappoint him. With an effort, he turned the slate over and beheld an image, clear as a vision seen through a window, of a garden of red and white roses lit by the pale rays of dawn. A gravel path ran through the beds of roses, and in the middle of the path was a woman, kneeling, cupping a white rose between her hands and smelling the flower, her eyes closed and a faint smile upon her lips. She was very beautiful, Aragorn thought. Her expression was soft and tender, yet she wore clothes of padded leather, with blackened bracers upon her forearms and greaves upon her shins, and a sword and dagger hanging from her waist. In the shape of her face, Aragorn could detect a hint of his own features, as well as a certain resemblance to Garrow, her brother. The image fascinated Aragorn. He pressed his hand against the surface of the Feirth, wishing that he could reach into it and touch her on the arm. "Mother!" Aramis said,
"Brom gave me the Feirth for safekeeping before he left for Carvajal, and now I give it to you." Without looking up, Aragorn asked,
"Would you keep it safe for me as well? It might get broken during our travelling and fighting."
The pause that followed caught Aragorn's attention. He wrenched his gaze away from his mother to see that Aramis appeared melancholy and preoccupied. "No, Aragorn, I cannot. You will have to make other arrangements for the preservation of the Feirth."
"Why?"
Aragorn wanted to ask, but the sorrow in Aramis's eyes dissuaded him. Then Aramis said, "Your time here is limited, and we still have many matters to discuss. Shall I guess which subject you would like to address next, or will you tell me?" With great reluctance, Aragorn placed the Feirth on the table and rotated it so that the image was upside down.
"The two times we have fought Murtagh and Thorn, Murtagh has been more powerful than any human ought to be. On the Burning Plains, he defeated Saphira and me because we did not realize how strong he was. If not for his change of heart, we would be prisoners in Urabain right now. You once mentioned that you know how Galbatorix has become so powerful. Will you tell us now, Master? For our own safety, we need to know."
"It is not my place to tell you this," said Aramis.
"Then whose is it?" demanded Aragorn. "You can't—"
Behind Aramis, Gleyder opened one of his molten eyes, which was as large as a round shield, and said,
"It is mine. The source of Galbatorix's power lies in the hearts of dragons. From us he steals his strength. Without our aid, Galbatorix would have fallen to the elves and the Varden long ago."
Aragorn frowned.
"I don't understand. Why would you help Galbatorix? And how could you? There are only four dragons and an egg left in Alagazia. Aren't there?"
"Many of the dragons, whose bodies Galbatorix and the Forsworn slew, are still alive today."
"Still alive?"
Bewildered, Aragorn glanced at Aramis, but the elf remained quiet, his face inscrutable. Even more disconcerting was that Saphira did not seem to share Aragorn's confusion. The gold dragon turned his head on his paws to better look at Aragorn, his scales scraping against one another.
"Unlike with most creatures," he said, "a dragon's consciousness does not reside solely within our skulls. There is in our chests a hard, gem-like object, similar in composition to our scales, called the Eldunari, which means the heart of hearts. When a dragon hatches, their Eldunari is clear and lusterless. Usually it remains so all through a dragon's life, and dissolves along with the dragon's corpse when they die. However, if we wish, we can transfer our consciousness into the Eldunari. Then it will acquire the same color as our scales, and begin to glow like a coal. If a dragon has done this, the Eldunari will outlast the decay of their flesh, and a dragon's essence may live on indefinitely. Also, a dragon can disgorge their Eldunari while they are still alive. By this means, a dragon's body and a dragon's consciousness can exist separately, and yet still be linked, which can be most useful in certain circumstances. But to do this exposes us to great danger. For whosoever holds our Eldunari holds our very soul in their hands. With it, they could force us to do their bidding, no matter how vile.
The implications of what Glada had said astounded Aragorn. Shifting his gaze to Saphira, he asked, "Did you already know about this?" The scales on her neck rippled as she made an odd, serpentine motion with her head.
"I have always been aware of my heart of hearts. Always I have been able to feel it inside of me, but I never thought to mention it to you."
"How could you not, when it's of such significance?"
"Would you think it worthy of mention that you have a stomach, Aragorn, or a heart, or a liver, or any other organ? My Eldunari is an integral part of who I am. I never considered its existence worthy of note. At least, not until we last came to Ellesmere."
"So you did know?"
"Only a little. Glada hinted that my heart of hearts was more important than I had originally believed, and he warned me to protect it, lest I inadvertently deliver myself into the hands of our enemies. More than that, he did not explain. But since then, I inferred much of what he just said."
"Yet you still did not think this was worth mentioning?"
demanded Aragorn.
"I wanted to,"
she growled.
"But as with Brom, I gave my word to Glada that I would speak of this to no one, not even to you."
"And you agreed?"
"I trust Glada, and I trust Oromis. Do you not?"
Aragorn scowled and turned back to the elf and the golden dragon.
"Why didn't you tell us of this sooner?"
Unstoppering the decanter, Oromis refilled his goblet with wine and said, "In order to protect Saphira."
"Protect her? From what?"
"From you,"
Glada said.
Aragorn was so surprised and outraged, he failed to regain his composure well enough to protest before Glada resumed speaking.
"In the wild, a dragon would learn about his Eldunari from one of his elders when he was old enough to understand the use of it. That way a dragon would not transfer themselves into their heart of hearts without knowing the full import of their actions. Among the riders, a different custom arose. The first few years of partnership between a dragon and a rider are crucial to establishing a healthy relationship between the two, and the riders discovered that it was better to wait until newly joined riders and dragons were well familiar with each other before informing them of the Eldunari. Otherwise, in the reckless folly of youth, a dragon might decide to disgorge his heart of hearts merely to appease or impress his rider. When we give up our Eldunari, we are giving up a physical embodiment of our entire being, and we cannot return it to its original place within our bodies once it is gone. A dragon should not undertake the separation of their consciousness lightly, for it will change how they live the rest of their lives, even if they should endure for another 1,000 years.
"Do you still have your heart of hearts within you?"
Aragorn asked. The grass around the table bent under the blast of hot air that erupted from Glada's nostrils.
"That is not a meat question to ask any dragon but Saphira. Do not presume to put it to me again, hatchling."
Although Glada's rebuke made Aragorn's cheeks sting, he still had the wherewithal to respond as he should, with a seated bow and the words, "No, master." Then he asked,
What happens if your Eldenari breaks?
If a dragon has already transferred their consciousness to their heart of hearts, then they will die a true death.
With an audible click, Glader blinked, his inner and outer eyelids flashing across the rayed orb of his iris.
Before we formed our pact with the elves, we kept our hearts in Dufeld's Nangoroth, the mountains in the center of the Hadarach Desert. Later, after the riders established themselves on the island of Roengard, and therein built a repository for the Eldunari, wild dragons and paired dragons both entrusted their hearts to the riders for safekeeping.
So then, said Aragorn, Galbatorix captured the Eldunari.
Contrary to Aragorn's expectations, it was Oromis who replied.
He did, but not all at once. It had been so long since anyone had truly threatened the riders, many of our order had become careless about protecting the Eldunari. At the time Galbatorix turned against us, it was not uncommon for a rider's dragon to disgorge their Eldunari merely for the sake of convenience.
Convenience?
Anyone who holds one of our hearts,
said Glader,
may communicate with the dragon from which it came without regard for distance. The whole of Aragazia might separate a rider and dragon, and yet if the rider had with him his dragon's Eldunari, they could share thoughts as easily as you and Saphira do now.
In addition, said Oromis, a magician who possesses an Eldunari can draw upon the dragon's strength to bolster his spells, again without regard for where the dragon might be. When a brilliantly coloured hummingbird interrupted their conversation by darting across the table. Its wings a throbbing blur, the bird hovered over the bowls of fruit and lapped at the liquid oozing from a crushed blackberry, then flitted up and away, vanishing among the trunks of the forest.
Oromis resumed speaking. When Galbatorix killed his first rider, he also stole the heart of the rider's dragon. During the years Galbatorix spent hiding in the wilderness thereafter, he broke the dragon's mind and bent it to his will, likely with the help of Durza. And when Galbatorix began his insurrection in earnest, with Morzan by his side, he was already stronger than most every other rider. His strength was not merely magical, but mental, for the force of the Eldunari's consciousness augmented his own. Galbatorix did not just try to kill the riders and dragons. He made it his goal to acquire as many of the Eldunari as he could, either by seizing them from riders, or by torturing a rider until his dragon disgorged its heart of hearts. By the time we realized what Galbatorix was doing, he was already too powerful to stop. It helped Galbatorix that many riders travelled not only with the Eldunari of their own dragon, but also with Eldunari of dragons whose bodies were no more. For such dragons often became bored with sitting in an alcove, and yearned for adventure. And of course, once Galbatorix and the Forsworn sacked the city of Doru Areba on the island of Roengard, he gained possession of the entire hoard of Eldunari stored therein. Galbatorix engineered his success by using the might and wisdom of the dragons against all of Alagasia. At first he was unable to control more than a handful of the Eldunari he had captured. It is no easy thing to force a dragon to submit to you, no matter how powerful you might be. As soon as Galbatorix crushed the riders and had installed himself as king in Urabane, he dedicated himself to subduing the rest of the hearts, one by one. We believe the task preoccupied him for the main part of the next 40 years, during which time he paid little attention to the affairs of Alagasia, which is why the people of Cirda were able to secede from the empire. When he finished, Galbatorix emerged from seclusion and began to reassert his control over the empire and the lands beyond. For some reason, after 2.5 years of additional slaughter and sorrow, he withdrew to Urabane again,
and there he has dwelt ever since, not so solitary as before, but obviously focused upon some project known only to him. His vices are many, but he has not abandoned himself to debauchery. That much the Varden spies have determined. More than that, though, we have not been able to discover. Lost deep in thought, Aragorn stared off into the distance. For the first time, all of the stories he had heard about Galbatorix's unnatural power made sense. A faint feeling of optimism welled up within Aragorn as he said to himself, "I'm not sure how, but if we could release the Eldunari from Galbatorix's control, he would be no more powerful than any normal dragon rider." Unlikely as the prospect seemed, it heartened Aragorn to know that the king did have a vulnerability, no matter how slight. As Aragorn continued to muse upon the subject, another question occurred to him. Why is it that I've never heard mention of the hearts of dragons in the stories of old? Surely, if they are so important, the bards and scholars would speak of them. Oromis laid a hand flat on the table then, and said, "Of all the secrets in Alagaesia, that of the Eldunari is one of the most closely guarded, even among my own people. Throughout history, dragons have striven to hide their hearts from the rest of the world. They revealed their existence to us only after the magical pact between our races was established, and then only to a select few." "But why?"
"Ah," said Gleda. "Often we despised the need for secrecy. But if ever the Eldunari had become common knowledge, every low-minded scoundrel in the land would have attempted to steal one, and eventually some would have achieved their goal. It was an outcome we went to great lengths to prevent."
"Is there no way for a dragon to defend themselves through their Eldunari?" Aragorn asked. Blader's eyes seemed to twinkle brighter than ever.
"An apt question. A dragon who has disgorged their Eldunari, but who still enjoys the use of their flesh, can, of course, defend their heart with their claws and their fangs and their tail, and with the battering of their wings. A dragon whose body is dead, however, possesses none of those advantages. Their only weapon is the weapon of their mind, and perhaps, if the moment is right, the weapon of magic, which we cannot command at will. That is one reason why many dragons did not choose to prolong their existence beyond the demise of their flesh. To be unable to move of your own volition, to be unable to sense the world around you except through the minds of others, and to only be able to influence the course of events with your thoughts, and with rare and unpredictable flashes of magic. It would be a difficult existence to embrace for most any creature, but especially dragons, who are the freest of all beings."
"Why would they then?" asked Aragorn.
"Sometimes it happened by accident. As their body was failing, a dragon might panic and flee into their Eldunari. Or if a dragon had disgorged their heart before their body died, they would have no choice but to continue to endure. But mostly the dragons who chose to live on in their Eldunari were those who were old beyond measure, older than Oromis and I are now. Old enough that the concerns of the flesh had ceased to matter to them, and they had turned in on themselves, and wished to spend the rest of eternity pondering questions younger beings could not comprehend. We revered and treasured the hearts of such dragons on account of their vast wisdom and intelligence. It was common for wild dragons and paired dragons alike, as well as riders, to seek advice from them on matters of importance. That Galbatorix enslaved them is a crime of almost unimaginable cruelty and evil." "Now I have a question," said Saphira,
the rich thrum of her thoughts running through Aragorn's mind.
"Once one of our kind becomes confined to their Eldunari, Must they continue to exist? Or is it possible for them, if they could no longer endure their condition, to release their hold on the world and pass into the darkness beyond?
Not on their own, said Aramis. Not unless the inspiration to use magic should sweep over the dragon and allow them to break their Eldunari from within, which to my knowledge has happened but rarely. The only other option would be for the dragon to convince someone else to smash the Eldunari for them. That lack of control is another reason why dragons were extremely wary of transferring themselves into their heart of hearts, lest they trap themselves in a prison from which there was no escape. Aragorn could feel Saphira's loathing at the thought of that prospect. She did not speak of it, however, but asked,
How many Eldunari does Galbatorix hold in his thrall?
We do not know the exact number, said Aramis, but we estimate that his hoard contains many hundreds. A wriggle shimmered down Saphira's glittering length.
So then our race is not on the verge of extinction after all?
Aramis hesitated, and it was Glader who answered.
Little one,
he said, startling Aragorn with the use of the epithet.
Even if the ground were covered with Eldunari, our race would still be doomed. A dragon preserved within an Eldunari is still a dragon, but they possess neither the urges of the flesh nor the organs with which to fulfill them. They cannot reproduce.
The base of Aragorn's skull began to throb, and he became increasingly aware of his weariness from the past 4 days of travelling. His exhaustion made it difficult to keep hold of thoughts for more than a few moments. At the slightest distraction, they slipped out of his grasp. The tip of Saphira's tail twitched.
I am not so ignorant as to believe that Eldunari could beget offspring. However, it comforts me to know I am not as alone as I once thought. Our race may be doomed, but at least there are more than 4 dragons alive in the world, whether they be cloaked in their flesh or not.
That is true, said Aramis. But they are as much Galbatorix's captives as Murtagh and Thorn.
Freeing them gives me something to strive for, though, along with rescuing the last egg, said Saphira.
It is something for us both to strive for, said Aragorn. We are their only hope.
He rubbed his brow with his right thumb, then said,
There is still something I don't understand.
Oh? Asked Aramis. Wherein lies your confusion?
If Galbatorix draws his power from these hearts, how do they produce the energy he uses?
Aragorn paused, searching for a better way to phrase his question. He gestured at the swallows flitting about in the sky.
Every living thing eats and drinks to sustain itself, even plants. Food provides the energy our bodies need to function properly. It also provides the energy we need to work magic, whether we rely upon our own strength to cast a spell or make use of the strength of others. How can that be, though, with these Eldunari? They don't have bones and muscle and skin, do they? They don't eat, do they? So then, how do they survive? Where does their energy come from?
Aramis smiled, his longish teeth glossy as enameled porcelain. From magic.
Magic?
If one defines magic as the manipulation of energy, which properly it is, then yes, magic. Where exactly the Eldunari acquire their energy is a mystery to both us and the dragons. No one has ever identified the source. It may be they absorb sunlight, as do plants, or that they feed off the life forces of the creatures closest to them. Whatever the answer, it has been proven that when a dragon undergoes body death, and their consciousness takes up sole residence in their heart of hearts, they bring with them however much spare strength was available within their body when it ceased to function. Thereafter their store of energy increases at a steady pace for the next 5 to 7 years, until they attain the full height of their power, which is immense indeed. The total amount of energy an Eldunari can hold depends upon the size of the heart. The older a dragon, the larger their Eldunari, and the more energy it can absorb before becoming saturated. Thinking back to when he and Saphira had battled Murtagh and Thorn, Eragon said, "Galbatorix must have given Murtagh several Eldunari. That's the only explanation for his increase in strength."
Oromis nodded. "You are fortunate Galbatorix did not lend him any more hearts. Else it would have been easy for Murtagh to overwhelm you, Arya, and all the other spellcasters with the Varden."
Eragon remembered how both times he and Saphira had encountered Murtagh and Thorn, Murtagh's mind had felt as if it contained multiple beings. Eragon shared his recollection with Saphira and said, "Those must have been the Eldunari I sensed. I wonder where Murtagh put them. Thorn carried no saddlebags, and I didn't see any odd bulges in Murtagh's clothing."
"I don't know," said Saphira. "You do realize that Murtagh must have been referring to his Eldunari when he said that instead of tearing out your own heart, it would be better to tear out his hearts. Hearts, not heart."
"You're right. Maybe he was trying to warn me."
Inhaling, Eragon loosened the knot between his shoulder blades and leaned back in his chair.
"Aside from Saphira's heart of hearts and Glaeda's, are there any Eldunari that Galbatorix hasn't captured?"
Faint lines appeared around the corners of Oromus's downturned mouth. "None that we know of. After the fall of the Riders, Brom went searching for Eldunari that Galbatorix might have overlooked, but without success. Nor in all my years of scouring Alagazia with my mind have I detected so much as a whisper of a thought from an Eldunari. Every Eldunari was well accounted for when Galbatorix and Morzan initiated their attack on us, and none of them vanished without explanation. It is inconceivable that any great store of Eldunari might be lying hidden somewhere, ready to help us if we could but locate them." Although Eragon had expected no other answer, he still found it disappointing.
"One last question. When either a rider or a rider's dragon dies, the surviving member of the pair would often waste away or commit suicide soon afterward, and those that didn't usually went mad from the loss. Am I right?"
"You are," said Glaeda.
"What would happen, though, if the dragon transferred their consciousness to their heart, and then their body died?"
Through the soles of his boots, Eragon felt a faint tremor shake the ground as Glaeda shifted his position. The gold dragon said,
"If a dragon experienced body death, and yet their rider still lived, together they became known as Indelvarn. The transition would hardly be a pleasant one for the dragon, but many riders and dragons successfully adapted to the change and continued to serve the riders with distinction. If, however, it was a dragon's rider who died, then the dragon would often smash their Eldunari, or arrange for another to smash it for them if their body was no more, thus killing themselves and following their rider into the void. But not all. Some dragons were able to overcome their loss, as were some riders, such as Brom, and continue to serve our order for many years afterward, either through their flesh or through their heart of hearts. You have given us much to think about, Oromis Elder,"
said Saphira. Eragon nodded, but stayed silent, for he was busy pondering all that had been said.
Hands of a Warrior. Eragon nibbled on a warm, sweet strawberry while he stared into the fathomless depths of the sky. When he finished eating the berry, he set the stem on the tray before him, pushing it into just the right spot with the tip of his forefinger,
and then opened his mouth to speak. Before he could, Oromis said,
"What now, Aragorn?"
"What now?"
"We have spoken at length on those subjects about which you were curious. What now do you and Sephira wish to accomplish? You cannot linger in Ellesmere, so I wonder what else you hope to achieve by your visit. Or is it your intention to depart again tomorrow morning?"
"We had hoped," Aragorn said, "that when we returned we would be able to continue our training as before. Obviously we haven't time for that now. But there is something else I would like to do."
"And that would be?"
"Master, I have not told you everything that happened to me when Brom and I were in Tirm." And then Aragorn recounted how curiosity had lured him into Angela's shop, and how she had told him his fortune, and the advice Solombum had given him afterward. Oromis drew a finger across his upper lip, his demeanour contemplative.
"I have heard this fortune-teller mentioned with increasing frequency throughout this past year, both by you and in Arya's reports from the Varden. This Angela seems to be most adept at turning up whenever and wherever events of significance are about to take place."
"That she is," confirmed Sephira.
Continuing, Oromis said, "Her behaviour reminds me very much of a human spellcaster who once visited the halls of Ellesmere, although she did not go by the name of Angela. Is Angela a woman of short stature, with thick, curly brown hair, flashing eyes, and a wit that is as sharp as it is odd?"
"You have described her perfectly," said Aragorn. "Is she the same person?"
Oromis made a small flicking motion with his left hand. "If she is, she is an extraordinary person. As for her prophecies, I would not devote much thought to them. Either they will come true or they will not. And without knowing more, none of us can influence the outcome. What the Weercat said, though, is worthy of far more consideration. Unfortunately, I cannot elucidate either of his statements. I have never heard of any such place as the Vault of Souls, and while the Rock of Cuthien strikes a familiar chord in my memory, I cannot recall where I have encountered the name. I will search my scrolls for it, but instinct tells me I will find no mention of it in Elvish writings."
"What of the weapon underneath the Manoa tree?"
"I know of no such weapon, Aragorn, and I am well acquainted with the lore of this forest. In all of Duweldenvarden there are perhaps only two elves whose learning exceeds my own where the forest is concerned. I will inquire of them, but I suspect it will be a futile endeavour." When Aragorn expressed his disappointment, Oromis said, "I understand that you require a suitable replacement for Zarok, Aragorn, and this I can help you with. Besides my own blade, Naegling, we elves have preserved two other swords of the Dragon Riders. They are Arvindr and Tamerlane. Arvindr is currently held in the city of Nadindel, which you have not the time to visit. But Tamerlane is here, in Ellesmere. It is a treasure of House Valtharos, and while the lord of their house, Lord Fiola, would not part with it eagerly, I think he would give it to you if you asked him respectfully. I will arrange for you to meet with him tomorrow morning."
"And what if the sword does not fit me?" asked Aragorn.
"Let us hope it does. However, I shall also send word to the smith Runan that she may expect you later in the day."
"But she swore she would never forge another sword."
Oromis sighed. "She did, but her advice would still be worth seeking out. If anyone can recommend the proper weapon for you, it would be she. Besides, even if you liked the feel of Tamerlane, I am sure Runan would want to examine the sword before you left with it. Over 100 years have elapsed since Tamerlane was last used in battle, and it might need some slight refurbishing."
"Could another elf forge me a blade?" asked Aragorn.
"Nay," said Oromis. "Not if it were to match the craftsmanship of Zarok, or whichever stolen sword Galbatorix has chosen to wield. Runan is one of the very oldest of our race, and it is she alone who has made the swords for our order.
She is as old as the riders?
Said Aragorn, amazed.
Older, even.
Aragorn paused.
What shall we do between now and tomorrow, Master?
Aramis looked over Aragorn and Saphira, then said,
Go and visit the Manoa tree. I know you will not rest easy until you have. See there if you can find the weapon the Weircat enticed you with. When you have satisfied your curiosity, retire to the quarters of your treehouse, which Islanzadi's servants keep in readiness for you and Saphira. Tomorrow we shall do what we can.
But, Master, we have so little time.
And the pair of you are far too tired for any more excitement today. Trust me, Aragorn. You will do better for the rest. I think the hours between will help you to digest all we have spoken of. Even by the measure of kings, queens, and dragons, this conversation of ours has been no light exchange.
Despite Aramis's assurances, Aragorn felt uneasy about spending the remainder of the day in leisure. His sense of urgency was so great he wanted to continue working, even when he knew he ought to be recuperating. Aragorn shifted in his chair, and by the motion he must have revealed something of his ambivalence, for Aramis smiled and said,
If it will help you relax, Aragorn, I promise you this. Before you and Saphira leave for the Varden, you may pick any use of magic, and in the brief while we have, I will teach you everything I can concerning it. With his thumb, Aragorn pushed his ring around his right index finger, and considered Aramis's offer, trying to decide what, of all areas of magic, he would most like to learn.
At last he said, I would like to know how to summon spirits.
A shadow passed over Aramis's face. I shall keep my word, Aragorn, but sorcery is a dark and unseemly art. You should not seek to control other beings for your own gain. Even if you ignore the immorality of sorcery, it is an exceptionally dangerous and fiendishly complicated discipline. A magician requires at least 3 years of intensive study before he can hope to summon spirits and not have them possess him. Sorcery is not like other magics, Aragorn. By it you attempt to force incredibly powerful and hostile beings to obey your commands. Beings who devote every moment of their captivity to finding a flaw in their bonds, so that they can turn on you and subjugate you in revenge. Throughout history, never has there been a shade who was also a rider, and of all the horrors that have stalked this fair land, such an abomination could easily be the worst. Worse even than Galbatorix. Please choose another subject, Aragorn. One less perilous for you and for our cause.
Then, said Aragorn, could you teach me my true name?
Your requests, said Aramis, grow ever more difficult, Aragorn Finiarel. I might be able to guess your true name if I so wished. The silver-haired elf studied Aragorn with increased intensity, his eyes heavy upon him. Yes, I believe I could, but I will not. A true name can be of great importance magically. But it is not a spell in and of itself, and so it is exempt from my promise. If your desire is to better understand yourself, Aragorn, then seek to discover your true name on your own. If I gave you it, you might profit thereof, but you would do so without the wisdom you would otherwise acquire during the journey to find your true name. A person must earn enlightenment, Aragorn. It is not handed down to you by others, regardless of how revered they be. Aragorn fiddled with his ring for another moment, then made a noise in his throat and shook his head.
Ah, I don't know. My questions have run dry.
That I very much doubt, said Aramis.
Aragorn found it difficult to concentrate upon the matter at hand. His thoughts kept returning to the Eldunari and to Brom. Again, Aragorn marvelled at the strange series of events that had led Brom to settle in Carvajal, and eventually to Aragorn himself becoming a dragon rider.
If Arya hadn't...
Aragorn stopped and smiled, as a thought occurred to him. "Will you teach me how to move an object from place to place without delay, just as Arya did with Saphira's egg?"
Oromis nodded. "An excellent choice. The spell is costly, but it has many uses. I am sure it will prove most helpful to you in your dealings with Galbatorix and the Empire. Arya, for one, can attest to its effectiveness."
Lifting his goblet from the table, Oromis held it up to the sun, and the radiance from above rendered the wine transparent. He studied the liquid for a long while, then lowered the goblet and said, "Before you venture into the city, you should know that he whom you sent to live among us arrived here some time ago." A moment passed before Aragorn realized to whom Oromis was referring.
"Sloane is in Ellesmere," said Aragorn, astonished.
"He lives alone in a small dwelling by a stream on the western edge of Ellesmere. Death was close upon him when he staggered out of the forest, but we tended the wounds of his flesh, and he is healthy now. The elves in the city bring him food and clothes, and otherwise see to it he is well cared for. They escort him wherever he wishes to go, and sometimes they read to him. But for the most part he prefers to sit alone, saying nothing to those who approach. Twice he has attempted to leave, but your spells prevented it."
"I'm surprised he arrived here so quickly," Aragorn said to Saphira.
"The compulsion you placed upon him must have been stronger than you realized."
"Aye," in a quiet voice Aragorn asked, "have you seen fit to restore his vision?"
"We have not."
"The weeping man is broken inside,"
Pleda said.
"He cannot see clearly enough for his eyes to be of any use."
"Should I go and visit him?" asked Aragorn, unsure of what Oromis and Gleda expected.
"That is for you to decide," said Oromis. "Meeting you again might only upset him. However, you are responsible for his punishment, Aragorn. It would be wrong for you to forget him."
"No, master, I won't." With a brisk motion of his head, Oromis set his goblet on the table and moved his chair closer to Aragorn.
"The day grows old, and I would keep you here no longer, lest I interfere with your rest. But there is one more thing I wish to attend to before you depart. Your hands. May I examine them? I would like to see what they say about you now." And Oromis held out his own hands toward Aragorn. Extending his arms, Aragorn placed his hands palm downward on top of Oromis's, shivering at the touch of the elf's thin fingers against the inside of his wrists. The calluses on Aragorn's knuckles cast long shadows across the backs of his hands as Oromis tilted them from side to side. Then, exerting a slight but firm pressure, Oromis turned Aragorn's hands over and inspected his palms and the undersides of his fingers.
"What do you see?" asked Aragorn.
Oromis twisted Aragorn's hands around again and gestured at his calluses.
"You now have the hands of a warrior, Aragorn. Take care they do not become the hands of a man who revels in the carnage of war."
The Tree of Life. From the crags of Telnair, Saphira flew low over the swaying forest until she arrived at the clearing wherein stood the Manoa tree. Thicker than 100 of the giant pines that encircled it, the Manoa tree rose toward the sky like a mighty pillar, its arching canopy thousands of feet across. The gnarled net of its roots radiated outward from the massive, moss-bound trunk, covering more than 10 acres of forest floor before the roots delved deeper into the soft soil and vanished beneath those of lesser trees. Close to the Manoa tree, the air was moist and cool, and a faint but constant mist drifted down from the mesh of needles above, watering the broad ferns clustered about the base of its trunk. Red squirrels raced along the branches of the ancient tree, and the bright calls and chirrups of hundreds of birds burst forth from the bramble-like depths of its foliage. And throughout the clearing, the sense of a watchful presence pervaded, for the tree contained within it the remnants of the elf once known as Linnea, whose consciousness now guided the growth of the tree and that of the forest beyond. Aragorn searched the uneven field of roots for any sign of a weapon.